Okay, so what I want to do is I want to look at pornography addiction. As I mentioned, pornography addiction is epidemic. It affects, I think, all of us in one degree or another, and we're going to continually face it. And so what I want to do is kind of unpack how does pornography addiction work? Like, why do people get hooked on pornography? How does it work? And maybe some helpful solutions for those who struggle and those we try to help who struggle. Because I think this is not going to go away. Again, this is a very personal topic to me. This is the very reason why I came to the Ministry of Journey Canada. I struggled for many years alone. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I tried to just fix myself, me and Jesus, be more spiritual, all this kind of stuff. And I got to the point of like, I've tried all these things. I'm a pastor. I'm married. And it's still not going away. And I went to Journey and like, okay, it helped me to understand some of the deeper layers of this because it's not as simple as I just want to be more committed to God, or God, just take it away. And so I want to unpack a little bit about that, but again, this comes out of my own journey of healing and of walking with lots of people through this topic. I don't know where my clicker went. Oh, here it is. Okay, so understanding porn addiction. I have a handout. That'll be a little bit later on. So I want to first begin by looking at what actually leads people to habitual struggles with sin. What leads people to bondage to sin or certain behaviors, habits, and in particular, pornography addiction? So I want to walk through this slideshow, this quick PowerPoint. Now, this is not, again, this is not the handout, so you can just kind of watch or you can write down notes if you want. But this is a simple illustration to kind of help you to understand why is it that people get addicted to pornography? Why is it that we have certain struggles in certain ways, in certain areas, okay? So look at this picture, how it should be. So how it should be is that you and I come into this world, and how it should be in life, the way God designed it, is that we come into this world and we have our parents around us who give us all the attention we need, all the affirmation we need. They give us a sense of endurance. They pour out their affection upon us. They instill in us confidence in who we are. They give us self-esteem. So we come into this world as babies, and many of us, you know, have, you know, all of us were babies, but some of us are parents, and we've seen that process of babies and children need a lot, right? They just don't have a lot when they come into this world. We have to pour that into them. We have to pour into them love. They can't eat on their own. They can't poop, you know, they can't clean their own poop. They can't comfort themselves. They can't love themselves. Like, we pour out all that stuff. And so hopefully how it should be is that we all come into this world, and from the time we're little infants through all different phases of development, as being a little toddler, to being a kid, to being an adolescent, to being an adult at 18 or, I don't know, 35, 40, I don't know when you become an adult, but eventually you become an adult and you've had so many good experiences. You've had so many good experiences. Everybody is pouring out their love, their blessing in your life, that you are so filled with love. You're so complete. You're so full that as an adult, you can just give that freely away because you have so much. How many of you, that was your experience growing up? Everything just went so well. You've had all of your needs met, right? Everything. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's usually not how it is for most of us. I think how it actually, sorry, I'm going back on this PowerPoint here. That's how it should be. But what actually happens, I think, for most of us is that we get bits and pieces of what we needed, okay? So our parents were able to give us some of the love we desired, some of the attention. You know, through hard times in life, they were able to give us maybe some help to persevere. We had some friends, but maybe we'd always didn't feel like we had enough, right? We got some good things, but there were these gaps in our life, if we're honest. If we're kind of looking at our life, yeah, there were some good things, but maybe not enough. And not only did we kind of lack some of the good that we needed, but for many of us, we've experienced some hard experiences, maybe abuse or painful experiences. Maybe we were neglected a lot as a child. Maybe something traumatic happened to us. Maybe we lost, you know, a loved one early on and it really devastated us. Maybe something happened in our family. Maybe it was divorce. Maybe, like, who knows, right? Maybe it was an abusive experience. Maybe it was bullying. Maybe it was just feeling left out. And many of us, not only have we not received the good, but we've received some negative experiences that kind of shaped our life, that begin to shape kind of our world, right? And so you know, the fact is, we still have these empty spaces, okay? If you did not receive the love that you needed, it does not mean you don't need love. Just because you didn't get the love, the attention that you crave, doesn't mean you don't need it. You actually still long for it. And so many of us, from early on, find other ways of receiving that, other ways of filling those gaps, those empty places inside. And so we'll fill those empty places with things like sexual experiences. Maybe we'll use food to kind of medicate ourselves, make ourselves feel better even for a while, give ourselves some comfort because nobody else can comfort us. Maybe we'll buy things to feel better about ourselves. I mean, this is becoming more and more prevalent now. Like, I love getting like an Amazon package. It's like, ooh, like I'm so excited. Just, you know, gives me a good feeling. Like, is it coming today? And I know it's, is there something at the door? And, you know, there's all these chemicals and endorphins. And I'm like, oh, I love that feeling. Materialism. We use that to make ourselves feel better, right? We use chemical addictions. We use relationships. We use kind of anything to kind of fill that gap when we didn't get what we really needed and desired. I mentioned I have three kids. My middle son, Everett, when he was young, he loved cinnamon buns. Okay, he loved cinnamon buns. He loved like those gooey ones, like not those dry ones, but he loved those really gooey, juicy ones with the icing and, you know, like Cinzeo or Cinnabon, like that kind of style of cinnamon buns he loved. And, you know, there's even in Calgary, there's this mall near our house, Market Mall, where one of the doors actually, there's like a Cinzeo like right there. So we would actually like avoid that door. We're like, we don't want to go close to that. Because then they're always like, take a little bite. Then he'd like, I want one. It's like $5 for like one. We're like, let's just avoid that whole thing because he loves cinnamon buns so much. So he loves cinnamon buns. And there was this one night, you know, he was having trouble sleeping. He's maybe our worst sleeper out of our three kids. And, you know, like as parents, you try all these different things to help your kids to sleep, right? It's like, oh, time for bed. They're like, okay. And then they're like, oh, I can't sleep. And it's like, okay, let's, you know, make sure your sheets are like nicely put together. Like, where's your stuffies? Like, maybe I'll massage your legs. Maybe I'll talk with you. Maybe get up and read for a bit. Like, you try all these methods, right? Those of you who have parents and hopefully, you know, I don't know, not hopefully. Hopefully you had kids that slept well, but most of us have one or two that just don't sleep. And you have all these methods, right? There was this one night where we tried all these things and he kept getting, he was like, I can't sleep, I can't sleep. We're like, okay, we tried method after method and it got to the point where he was just like, he was overtired, right? As parents, you know, like your kids get tired and then they're like overtired when it's like they're beyond hope, like they're just crazy, right? And then we got to the point where we were getting crazy and we're like, Everett, like you need to go to sleep. Like, how can we help you? What do you need? And he said, I need cinnamon buns, okay? It's like, I need cinnamon buns. Now, as a parent, you're just like, that's not what you need, right? But in his little brain, like this, he was like 3 or 4 years old, right? He had already made the connection. Cinnamon buns would make me feel better. Like, ooh, that gooey bite of cinnamon. Ooh, that would just make me feel better. Now, what was his real need, his legitimate real need? Rest, sleep. But in his brain, he made the connection. But cinnamon buns will make me feel better, even for a moment, right? And I think all of us learn to kind of do this in one way or another, and we learn to do this really early on in life. What makes us feel better, even for a moment? What gives us just a little sense of escape? What gives us that little sense of reward, escaping our problems for a little bit, escaping our anxiety, our discomfort, even for a little bit, gives us some kind of satisfaction, right? And this is how addictions develop to many different things, right? Some addictions that we have are, you know, more blatantly obvious than others, right? And some of them are seen as more morally wrong than others, but I think all of us have different things we turn to, right? Think for yourself, what's your go-to when it's been a hard day, when you've been stressed, when you've been tired, when you feel like people haven't been meeting your needs? What is the thing that you're like, I want to do that thing? Sitting down and praying to Jesus? Well, what do you do? What do you do on those bad days when you don't turn to Jesus, right? Like many of us would like to say, oh, I just turn to Jesus and he meets all my needs. Okay, let's be realistic. What else do you turn to, right? What are those things that you use to fill those gaps? Well, the fact is, for many people today, they turn to pornography because it's easy, it's quick, and it has a visceral effect on the body, on chemicals in our brain. And so many people are getting addicted to pornography as the thing they turn to when they start to feel a bit stressed, when some of their emptiness begins to get rubbed in the wrong way. And they've learned from early on that pornography can make me feel better. Even though they know it's not really going to meet their needs, at least it's an escape. Let me share for you how this kind of worked in my own life. So I was born and raised in Calgary. My parents are Japanese. They were Japanese immigrants. They landed in Calgary in the early 70s. And growing up, I'm the youngest of four kids, and my parents really did provide like a lot for us. Like, they were good parents. They provided a lot. I never felt like unsafe in my home. I was kind of babied, and so my siblings all said, like, they all got spanked, but by the time I came around, like, my parents were like done spanking. So they're like, you were spoiled and all this kind of stuff. You're the baby of the family. How many babies of the family are there? We're the best, right? Babies of the family. My wife is also a baby. Baby of the family. So a lot of things were good, but one of the things I definitely lacked in my growing up, you know, looking back at all those needs, right? Affection, attention, confidence, all those things. What I definitely lacked growing up was affection. Like, my family did not do affection. My parents are very typical Japanese. I've never seen my parents kiss. I've never seen them hug. I've never seen them hold hands. I've never heard them say, I love you, either to each other or to me. Like, that just never happened in my home. That just wasn't part of their upbringing, isn't typically part of Japanese culture to be physically expressive at all, and definitely didn't happen for me growing up. I heard a joke once about a Japanese man who was sitting at the dinner table, and he was looking across the table at his wife, and he realized how much he loved her that he almost told her. You guys are catching the joke? Okay. Yeah, he loved her and all this stuff, but it just never came out, right? That was my family. Like, I knew my parents loved me, etc., but they never said it. I just knew in my head that they loved me, even though there was never any demonstration of that ever. Now, that would really come to affect me in terms of my coping, because when I was 12 years old, my oldest brother, who was 17, drowned the summer he graduated high school. So my brother was 17, graduated grade 12, and that summer he died just outside of Calgary, cliff jumping with some friends. Totally screwed me up as a 12-year-old kid. I just finished grade 6, and I lost my brother, who I looked up to. No way to understand that trauma, and no ability for my parents to really navigate us through the grief. So in that experience, I never saw my dad cry once. I don't have a single memory of my family grieving together. And I think I cried the day my brother died, and then I just shoved it all down. Because that was my family. Like, we didn't talk about it, and I never saw my dad demonstrably showing any grief. And so I was so detached from my emotions that by the time of my brother's funeral, I didn't even cry at my own brother's funeral. I was so emotionally detached. So definitely some gaps in terms of my upbringing, things that I desperately needed but just weren't there, pain in my life. And that's when I started to get hooked on pornography. I'd kind of seen it before, but after that summer, I just totally gravitated towards it. There was something about it that I just couldn't turn away from. As an adult, it makes sense, right? Looking back, like, man, I was just a 12-year-old kid, like, looking to escape pain, like wanting to just escape his situation, like getting lost in these images that look like pleasure, that look like love, look like intimacy, look like some kind of human connection. But I got hooked at 12, and it began to kind of feed this part of me that was desperate for comfort, desperate for love. So I began to fill myself with that. And again, all of us do this with one thing or another, right? Sex, relationships, work, working hard for other people's affirmation, right? What is it that we turn to try to meet our own needs? Okay. The reality is pornography has become so epidemic now as something that people turn to because it's so readily available. I talk at youth groups sometimes, and this is about 2 years ago, I think. This is at Foothills Alliance Church, so it's a big church in Calgary. I talked to their youth group. And so this youth group was junior high and high school kids, and there was about 85 kids. So it was a pretty large youth group, obviously. And I did this talk on kind of sex and pornography and that kind of stuff. And I did this anonymous survey to the kids. And so there was about five questions, and I handed it out, and then the kids filled it out, and then I got it back. And this was one of the questions: have you feared that you may be developing an addiction to pornography? Okay, and so this was the response. Junior high girls, I think it was only one out of, I think there are 25 junior high girls, only one of them said yes to, I think I might be, do you, have you feared you may be developing an addiction to pornography? Junior high boys, the response was 30%. Okay, so about one in three boys in junior high are already saying, I think I might be developing an addiction to pornography. So they're not just exposed to it, but some habitual, they're starting to get habitually hooked on turning to pornography, using pornography. Senior high girls jumped up to 39%. High school girls, okay, it's almost 40%. This was not a small sample. There were over 20 high school girls filled this out. Okay, so this is 40% of, this one kind of blew me away. I was like, wow, 40% of high school girls already. Something happens between junior high and high school and exposure now to girls. Like, it used to, pornography used to only be talked about as a men's issue or a guy's issue. It is definitely a woman's issue nowadays, right? There is pornography being catered towards women. And then high school boys, 45%. So already by the time kids now are leaving public school, when you talk about sins that they struggle with, when you talk about what are the ways that you struggle in your faith, right? We're talking about pornography for a large group of kids. They're being so exposed to this, and it's so easy, and it's becoming such a habitual thing that they turn to, that they're already calling it an addiction by this age, right? I was 12 when I was exposed. I just turned 40 this summer. A lot of people my age, you know, around my age, kind of talk about 12 as a pretty average age, but they're now kind of saying, you know, average age of exposure, 8 to 10 years old, maybe, is around average, right? Some definitely less than that. And so kids are developing habitual patterns by the time they're 12, 13 years old already, right? This is kind of the world we live in. Okay. I asked this, I did this same questionnaire at Ambrose. So in Calgary, that's the Alliance and Nazarene Bible College and Seminary and Liberal Arts School. And I did this, a similar talk about sexual health for people in ministry. So this was third and fourth year students all doing internships in churches. So these are, you know, kids who feel, all of them feel like God's called me into ministering in the church. And they're all in their third and fourth year, all doing internships. And so they're all going to be a pastors in a year or two somewhere in churches. And there were 21 men. This is over 2 years. 21 men and 11 women. And, you know, I did this talk, and not this talk, but a talk on sexual wholeness in ministry and how important that is and deal with your crap, you know, stuff like that. And then I did this anonymous survey again. So what were the stats? 85%, 18 out of 21 guys said, I think I might be addicted to pornography. 18 out of the 21 guys said that, and 4 of the 11 girls said, I think I might be addicted to pornography, right? And this is the cream of the crop of our church, you know, the ones who feel committed to God, the ones who probably had some kind of profound experience of God, and they're committing their life to the Lord, and there's this huge issue of pornography addiction that is kind of overwhelming them, probably, you know, for many of them. This is a huge issue. Okay, so we can go to that next PowerPoint. So what I want to do now, you guys have that handout. So grab this handout, because what I want to do is actually walk you through, now that I've talked about, okay, people get addicted to stuff. People turn to who knows what to meet their own needs, oftentimes pornography. So what does that actually look like? So I want to walk through this cycle of addiction. And for me, this was huge when I was introduced to it, and I still use it, and I still think about it. I talk about my addiction and my patterns in these terms because it's helped me to break down what is actually happening for me in terms of my struggle. And I walk this through with guys when I do support groups. This is what I'll get them to kind of do. I say guys not because it's only guys, but I only work with guys and not women, but this is what I kind of walk through. So I want to kind of talk through what does it look like when people are addicted to pornography? Because the fact is, I turned to pornography as a young person to escape from life, but as I grew through puberty and adolescence, all that kind of stuff, I began to funnel all of my needs to pornography. So it wasn't just for escape. It's what I turned to when I felt lonely. It's what I began to turn to when I felt stressed. It's what I began to turn to when I felt rejected. It's what I turned to for a reward when I did something good. It's what I turned to when I felt isolated. Like, everything began to get funneled into pornography, and it became this pattern. So if we can begin to recognize our patterns, we can begin to unpack it. So I want to talk through, what does the cycle of addiction kind of look like? Okay, so here's that picture. So we have, at core, some real legitimate needs and pain, right, at core. But again, many of us don't know how to meet our real needs, and don't want to look at our pain. So instead of actually addressing those core issues, right, real legitimate needs and pain, we don't want to go there, we want to go around that, and this is where addiction comes in. So how it usually works is that we have a trigger, and I think, that's outlined there. So we have a trigger. And so what do I mean by a trigger? Well, I'm going to talk about a sexual trigger. So that's the first blank. Sexual trigger. So for an addict, for myself, you know, what would happen oftentimes is I would see something provocative, right? So it would be something on the internet, a news story. Maybe it was an advertisement on TV. Maybe it was somebody who was walking down the street. Maybe it's a billboard, you name it, whatever. There was some kind of sexual trigger that then started me down this path of thinking about sexual things. So leave that second blank, leave it empty, and move on to this next one. Because once you're triggered, you move on to preoccupation. So preoccupation here. So I've seen the billboard, but I've walked by it, but now that image is stuck in my head. And I'm thinking about that image, I'm beginning to be preoccupied. Maybe I'm thinking about that image, maybe I'm thinking about other images I've seen, maybe I'm thinking about where I can see more of that. Maybe I'm just obsessing about women, body parts. Maybe I'm thinking about websites. And I'm beginning to be preoccupied by sexual things or by where I can find other things. So preoccupation works even though we're doing other things. We may be at work, we may be talking to people, but there's something kind of slowly starting to churn in our mind. I'm beginning to be preoccupied about that thing that I want or about, you know, we kind of start to churn it over in our mind, okay? We're beginning to be preoccupied, double-minded by these thoughts. Now that leads oftentimes is connected to rationalizations. We begin to rationalize our thinking or maybe our behavior or our situation. So we begin to rationalize, whereas before we said, I don't want to do that, we begin to rationalize and say, well, maybe it's not so bad of a thing. I've been working hard lately. My wife hasn't been nice. We've been fighting. So I don't really care if this hurts her. I've been praying to God about a lot of stuff. He's not answering my needs, right? So we begin to wrestle in our minds with rationalization. And this is where some of our faulty beliefs about life can come in. Our faulty beliefs saying, nobody loves me, right? Man, I'm all alone. I'm so lonely. God doesn't meet my needs. This isn't hurting anybody. At least I'm not having sex with somebody. I'm just going to look at pornography. God doesn't understand. I have the right to do this. So we begin to really wrestle. Like, this is a lot of things are happening in our mind. We're getting preoccupied. We're beginning to rationalize. We have all these faulty beliefs about ourselves, right? Oh, I'm just a loser. Like, I'm so stressed out, and man, nobody seems to care about my life. Like, we begin to get, you know, a lot of these kinds of thoughts bombarding us. And so we're really struggling in our mind and in our imagination. And then it leads to, at the bottom, ritualization. So not only do we have thoughts in our mind, but we begin to ritualize. So ritual means, you know, that's something you do over and over again. So you're not looking at pornography yet, or you're not doing anything yet, but you're doing things that are leading towards it. So it could be, just flipping through the channels. Right, you know, what are some of the new shows that are on Netflix? Just browsing YouTube, maybe reading news stories. Maybe it's going to the mall and walking down certain stores. Maybe it's hanging out in certain places where there are certain kinds of people. Like, this is part of our ritual. We're kind of walking down that path where we're kind of wanting to expose ourselves maybe to a bit more, excitement, exposing ourselves to things. But if anybody caught us, we could kind of have an excuse, right? So it's like, what are you doing at the mall? It's like, oh, I'm just here looking for some new shoes, right? I remember one time when I was a seminary student in Vancouver, and if any of you know Vancouver, there's some nice beaches there, and And I was like, you know what? I'm going to go to Kitts Beach because I want to study. It's such a beautiful day. And I was there and I was studying my theology on Kitts Beach. But really, I was kind of looking around at people too. But if anybody asked me, I'd be like, oh, I'm just studying, man. This is a great place, right? But there's a part of me that's kind of in the back of my mind, this preoccupation, this, and I'm starting to ritualize. I'm starting to go down that path. Rituals can oftentimes be places or times, right? Maybe Friday night's a ritual for some people. It's like, oh, I start to gear up for certain things on Friday night, or when my wife leaves for a while, that's part of my ritual, or part of my ritual is just endless browsing, and I kind of get into this tunnel vision kind of state. And so we begin to have certain behaviors associated with this. So there's rituals, and they're called rituals for a reason. You do the same things. You know, if you reflect on your life, your rituals will usually kind of look very similar. At the stage of ritualization is when our mind begins to get quite foggy because we've been preoccupying. We've been kind of, you know, sometimes having self-pity, all those faulty beliefs. We begin to get kind of tunnel vision where all we're beginning to think about is what we want and how much that'll make us happy, how we deserve it. And we kind of lose track of our values and how this might affect other people, how it might affect us, and we get kind of tunnel visioned. And this is where temptation comes in, right? This is where the enemy says, yeah, there's no consequences, right? Who said you shall die if you eat that apple? Don't you know that it'll make you, you know, there's all these benefits to it? And I think as we engage temptation and we kind of just get more and more tunnel vision. If any of you learn how to ski, it's, you know, when you learn how to ski, you first do snow plowing. I don't know if you guys, any of you take ski lessons, you put your skis like this so that you can kind of control yourself while you're going down the ski hill. Now, how many of you remember the first time you put your skis like straight, like what does that feel like? And you start to shoot down the hill and you're like, holy cow, I'm going so fast. I don't even want to turn. Like, and all I see is kind of what's ahead of me. That's kind of the stage of ritualization. Like you're going down the hill, you've become kind of tunnel visioned. You're so fixated on this thing that you kind of want, right? And when you do that long enough, you're going to act out, okay? So where are we here? You're going to act out, right? So what does that mean? For the pornography addict, the sex addict, it's looking at pornography, masturbation, maybe it's going on an app, sexting, maybe it's, you know, you kind of name it, whatever that looks like. You know, you cross that line. Masturbation, orgasm, anonymous sexual encounter, whatever, right? So you've acted out. Now, after acting out, what's the next stage? Euphoria and bliss? No, despair, right? You're in despair with your addiction. How did I do this again? I told myself I would never do this again. I vowed to myself I would never do this again. I told God I would never do this again. I remember this feeling. How did I get here again? And you begin to despair. Maybe there's something screwed up with me. Maybe I lack faith. Self-hatred is a part of this, right? You begin to whip yourself. What's wrong with me? You know, I'm so screwed up, right? And you really end up in a pit of despair, these negative feelings, okay? Now, that despair has an arrow back into a trigger because none of us like feeling in despair. None of us like feeling in the dumps. And so after a while, we begin to think, well, what can make me feel better? Oh, preoccupation, right? Give it a few days and begin to be preoccupied again. Oh, maybe instead of dealing with my pain, instead of dealing with how I feel about myself, I want to escape. Again, you don't want to look at your real needs. You don't know how to meet your real needs. You don't want to look at your pain, so you get right back into your cycle. Give it a couple of days and you're right back in, and then you just start to swirl around this cycle. Now, on the trigger point, I talked about sexual triggers. Now, there are a whole host of non-sexual triggers. So write down non-sexual. Meaning, I used to always just think, oh, it's if I get rid of, like, sexual temptation, it should go away. But the reality is, I engaged in my cycle as a way to cope in life. So stress for me is a huge trigger. Feeling lonely is a huge trigger. Feeling criticized is a huge trigger. Feeling insecure is a huge trigger. Feeling like somebody's not seeing me for who I am and my value is a big trigger. You name it, right? A whole host of non-sexual triggers, right? Alcoholics Anonymous uses the acronym HALT. Are you hungry, angry, lonely, or tired? Are you hungry, Are you angry? Are you lonely? Are you tired? Be aware of those, because those will make you go for a drink, or those will make you begin to escape into fantasy leading you down this path. Right? Those are huge triggers. Are you hungry right now? Are you lonely, angry, tired? Halt. Hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Right? Now this pattern, you know, for me began when I was a kid. This is pre-internet, you know, and so as a junior high kid, I would begin to preoccupy about where I could find pornography, and I'd have to steal it from somewhere, and I'd use it, and I'd feel bad, and I'd throw away my pornography, saying I would never do that again, like I don't like it, how it makes me feel, give it a few more days, and I was just craving for it again. Again, because my real needs hadn't been met, and my pain hadn't been met. And so I'm just desperate again for my drug of choice. And once I found something, again, it's not what I need, it's cinnamon buns, right? I don't know how to meet my real needs, but I've tasted this and it tastes good, so I'm back at it again. And this is how the cycle of addiction just really debilitates people. Like people feel in bondage because of this. How do I do this again and again, right? And there is a lot of spiritual battle here. Satan comes to us and says, why don't you do this? Then when we do it, he condemns us and says, look at you, God must not like you. He's the tempter and the accuser. He's getting us there, and then he kicks us when we're down, right? God wouldn't forgive you. No one would accept you if they knew this about you, right? And this becomes a real place of bondage. The more that you engage in this behavior, the more automatic it becomes. So you're not even making choices anymore. It's like you're triggered, you're feeling bad, and you're already starting to browse YouTube or something. Like it's just become such an automatic thing, right? You're beginning to feel antsy. You're already doing something, right, to get rid of that. It becomes automatic. The more you do this, the darker your behaviors tend to get. You'll start to push boundaries. So it used to start as, you know, looking at people in swimsuits. Then it goes to, you know, pornography, then video, then chat rooms, then, you know, you kind of name it. When you start to cross boundaries, it just becomes easier to cross them. You just go deeper and deeper. When I've been involved in this ministry for about 13 years, when I was even 13 years ago, you know, once in a while I'd hear somebody talk about, you know, going on chat rooms or like something like that, or having some anonymous sexual encounter. That just happens all the time now because it is so quick, right? People have this desire, this urge. They've seen so much. They've exposed themselves to so much. It doesn't seem like a big jump to just go and do this with somebody, right? It becomes so quick. The more you do this, the more automatic it becomes. The darker the behaviors become. It becomes normal, right? You kind of need more for the same fix. Let me read for you, if this sounds familiar, from Romans chapter 7. And this is from The Message, Eugene Peterson's translation. I need something more. This is Romans chapter 7, starting verse 17. I know the law, but I can't keep it. And the power of sin within me keeps sabotaging my best intentions. I obviously need help. I don't have what it takes. I can will it, but I can't do it. I decide to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyways. My decisions, such as they are, don't result in actions. Something has gone wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. It happens so regularly that it's predictable. The moment I decide to do good, sin is there to trip me up. I truly delight in God's commands, but it's pretty obvious that not all of me joins in that delight. Parts of me covertly rebel, and just when I least expect it, they take charge. I've tried everything and nothing helps. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? The answer, thank God, is that Jesus Christ can and does. He acted to set things right in this life of contradictions where I want to serve God with all my heart and mind, but am pulled by the influence of sin to do something totally different. I mean, pornography addiction is something kind of new in some ways, but it's really just a manifestation of addiction to sin, right? Of bondage to sin. You know, I'm turning to something to meet my own needs. I'm being tempted away and I'm in bondage to this thing that I can't stop doing. There's this war within me that I can't overcome, right? Pornography addiction is just a manifestation of this human reality. Okay. Now, technology has changed pornography addiction immensely as well. People talk about the three A's of internet addiction that make it the crack cocaine of addiction. Three A's, three things starting with A. Number one, it's affordable, which is, you know, it's affordable. If you have something that connects with Wi-Fi, you can access all the pornography in the world. It's affordable. It's anonymous, right? You don't have to go to a store and go buy a magazine or go into a certain place to get it. You have your phone. You can do it when you're sitting on your toilet, when you're at home by yourself, when you're driving, anywhere, right? It's affordable, it's accessible, or anonymous, and it's accessible, okay? Affordable, anonymous, accessible. Because of this, sexual addiction has exploded, right? Think about it. When I was a kid, I had to plan for days to find pornography, okay? It's like, well, where am I going to get it? Oh, there's that one corner store, and maybe I can steal it from that place, and like, you know, I'll get off on my bus stop, and I'll walk over there, and then I can try to find it. I mean, what do people do now? You know, if I asked you right now, can you find pornography within a minute? How many of you could probably do that? I'm not asking you to do it, right? Everybody, right? Everybody. And so in any moment of weakness, you can just lose yourself. You can just fantasize, right? Right? It's so prevalent now. Obviously, pornography addiction has huge effects on people. Huge amounts of shame, guilt, hiddenness, right? This is not the stuff you share with people. Like, hey, when you go to Sunday morning, hey, how's it going? You don't say, well, this is happening for me. Like, none of us say that. We're like, oh, I'm doing fine. You know, I'm not going to tell you what happened last night, right? But this is like happening for so many people, right? And if it's not pornography, I mean, put in your drug of choice. What is it? You know, a whole tub of ice cream? Maybe it's a whole tub of ice cream, right? Oh man, like I'm just feeling like crap. I'm just gonna stop at the store on the way home. Oh, it's my favorite ice cream. It's on sale this week, and I've been thinking about it ever since the flyers came on Thursday. So I've been obsessing about having that scoop. Oh, and I love that first bite. Now I'm, you know, I should just have one, but oh, I'm just gonna have like three. Nobody's home, and oh, this is gonna, same thing really, right? How do I escape my problems? I don't want to deal with my pain. I don't know how to comfort myself. I don't know how to rely on people. What is your drug of choice? What are those things you turn to, right? Okay, so that's the cycle of addiction, okay? What I want to talk about now, let me just check my time here. Okay, I'm going to talk about for a little bit is what is the process of healing and transformation from this, okay? When I work with people, I explain this and I say, think about it, go home for a week, and let's talk about it next week. And, you know, they all come back and say, oh yeah, I could see this happening, right? I can now name it. These are triggers. I can now name it. Oh, this is what I do in preoccupation. Oh, I begin to have these thoughts. These are my rituals. They begin to actually recognize this patterning. And this is hugely important because we have to understand our struggles with sin are not like this. Oh, I'm doing fine. Oh, I just sinned out of nowhere, right? I stumbled into sin. That's not how it works, people. That's not how it works. We usually have these things that we're actually making choices of what we think about, of what we do, of what we choose not to do, and then we actually sin. It feels like maybe we're not choosing it, but it's because we've made all these other choices to not deal with it. And when you actually unpack this cycle, you actually begin to recognize, oh, I'm actually making choices here. When I'm triggered, I'm actually making a choice to preoccupy. Even though I may not feel like it after all, I'm making choices to rationalize, to dwell on these false beliefs. I'm making a choice to not actually meet my real needs. I'm actually making a choice to not reach out for help. I'm getting stuck in my rituals. I'm acting out. I'm alone. I feel remorse, and I choose to stay in this alone, and I just go back in my cycle. Right? These are a lot of choices that we make. But once we can begin to understand it, we can begin to unpack it. So I want to talk about just some broadly speaking. I mean, I can. We do seminars on this for literally from 9 to 4 p.m., and, you know, I'm just doing an hour, okay? What are some of the things that we can do? This is my favorite quote about addiction. Freedom is not the absence of struggle, but the ability to make new choices in the midst of struggle. Okay, this is really important for us as Christians to hear. Freedom is not the experience of saying, I don't struggle anymore. Okay, do not equate freedom or God's healing as, I don't struggle, right? That's not realistic. The Bible does not say that, right? But freedom is absolutely possible, and it usually looks like the ability to make healthier choices in your life. Okay? Temptation will probably be with you for the rest of your life. Okay? Healing is not about not experiencing temptation. It's what do you do with temptation? Okay? So freedom is about the ability to make new choices in the midst of your struggle. So what are some of the things we can do? I'm just going to go over some broad things. Number one, remove temptations or set limits in your life. The fact is we have so much temptation thrown at us all the time. Internet, television, phones, apps, ads, media, etc. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, right? I mean, he has really wise and relevant words for us in regards to lust. If your eye causes you to sin, blank, gouge it out. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. So he's talking pretty drastic here. Now, obviously, most of us understand he's not talking literally here, but he's using really clear and blunt language to say, this is really important. Make some drastic choices that are going to make your life uncomfortable, but it's going to be good for you in the long run. Right? What does he say? Do this so that you will not burn in hell forever. Right? So cut off your hand if it's causing you to sin. Get rid of stuff. What would that look like in our modern context? Let me tell you what I have to do in my own life. We have Netflix, but I do not know the password to watch anything above mature. Right? So if I want to watch a war movie, which is my favorite genre, I have to go with the iPad to my wife and say, can you punch in the code? I want to watch this movie. Thank you. And I watch it. Right? Because I know that if left to my own devices, I'm just going to scroll. Right? There's just too much coming at me. I have covenant eyes on my phone, my laptop, my work desktop. I do not know the passwords on any of our iPads or anything to download new apps. We have Telus at home. I do not know the password to unlock parental, adult kind of stuff, et cetera, et cetera, right? All these limits on my life. And it kind of makes my life a little bit irritating, right? But I need to do that, right? If your eye is causing you to sin, gouge it out. Put some limits on your life. I have one staff member who has a flip phone. And he's like, I feel kind of ashamed. I'm on the bus and I'm like this. And he's like, I don't want people to know that I have this. But he's like, he needed to make that choice. He said, I cannot live with a smartphone. So I'm going to gouge out my eye and have a flip phone. They still exist, right? But what are the things you need to do, right? And Jesus is being pretty blunt here. If your eye is causing sin, gouge it out. I think many of us are just really, are not making wise choices in terms of the technology we allow ourselves to have. Right? And some of us need to be honest with ourselves, have honest conversations with our spouses, have honest conversations in our homes about what we can and can't have. Right? I've been working on this issue for 20 years, and I still need all this. Right? Not because I'm just this weak, unfaith, you know, I don't have faith. It's because I know how weak I am, and I want to save myself. I actually want to live a healthy life, so I put these drastic limits into my life. And this stuff happens constantly. Just a few weeks ago, you know, I was texting my friends and saying, oh, I'm really struggling. I have these images that I saw online. And they're like, oh, where did it come from? I'm like, oh, is this online shopping place that sent me this, we got a sale this week. And then they're like, well, why don't you unsubscribe? And I was like, unsubscribe? That's so simple. But I've been letting this weekly email thing bombarded me with images for like years, I think. I haven't bought anything from this place for a long time, and yet it just became a part of my life, and it's like, unsubscribe. Okay, that makes sense, right? Cut things out of your life, right? We need to do that. But you definitely can't stop there. That is just the very basic thing that we need to do. But we need to go deeper than that. We need to have awareness of our cycle. Because what Jesus also said in the Sermon on the Mount is not just cut out stuff from your life, but that lust begins in your heart, right? You can't just cut out the external and think, oh, now I've dealt with it, because our struggles are actually begin in the heart. So we actually have to understand our heart. What's happening for us? What are some of the ways in which our heart is deceiving us, right? That our imagination is beginning to be shaped by our addiction cycle. Going back to the cycle of addiction, most people that I work with, when I first work with them, they can only describe this. They're like, oh, I struggle with pornography. Can you help me? I'm like, well, tell me about it. It's like, well, I struggle with pornography and I feel bad and I recognize some of my sexual triggers, right? They're like, can you help me stop that? And my answer is, you can only stop that by recognizing all of this, okay? Are you willing to kind of look at that? Because lust begins in the heart. Where does this begin for you? What are your triggers? What are your rationalizations? When do you tend to struggle? Are you willing to actually take stock of your life and recognize your patterns? Because only you know it. I don't know it. I can't look at your life and tell you what it is. You need to really reflect on your life. What am I really struggling with and why? Right? And write out, for me, this is what my cycle looks like. People usually say, how do I stop looking at porn? And I ask them the question, well, why do you look at porn? Right? Have you ever asked yourself, why do you look at it? When do you tend to? Right? Are we willing to do that, or are we just saying, well, I don't know, I just want to stop this? Right? It's really impossible unless you're willing to look at all of this stuff. Again, what are my patterns? When do I know I'm not doing well? Especially looking at triggers. Okay? Especially looking at triggers. What are your triggers? Triggers, I would say, are 85% of the battle with pornography addiction. What are your triggers? Because that's the question of asking, why are you turning to this? Are you aware of why you're turning to this? One of the stories I've been reflecting on a lot lately is the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4. It's surprising, but I've been landing on this so much in terms of pornography addiction. Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4. This is one of the earliest stories in Scripture. In fact, if you think about it, it's the first story of how sin manifested itself after the fall. Right? Adam and Eve sinned, their children. Okay, how does sin manifest in their lives? Cain and Abel. Well, what is the story about? If many of you are maybe familiar with it, both brothers sacrificed to God. For some reason, God didn't like Cain's sacrifice as much as Abel's. So it says Cain got mad, right? And God came to him and said, why are you mad? So it's right here. God came to him and said, why are you angry? Why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it. So what's happening here? Okay, Cain is mad. His face has fallen. Ugh, life hasn't gone my way. Somebody doesn't like me, right? Now God's saying, what are you going to do with that feeling? What are you going to do with feeling upset? What are you going to do when things don't go your way, when your ego gets hurt? Right? And this is an important question. What are you going to do with these feelings? Because you know what? Sin is crouching at the door. Sin has an answer to that irritation you feel, right? And for him, it was anger and killing his brother. But I think this is how it works with pornography addiction. Why has your face fallen? What's happening for you internally? Why are you mad? Why are you triggered? Why are you anxious? Right? Are you willing to look at that? Are you willing to look at what's happening at core? How do you respond to negative emotions? And I think when we begin to ask these deep questions, and this is what we do at our journey courses, we take a lot of time to kind of unpack, how did you get to the place where you are? What was your childhood like growing up? What was your family of origin? What did you learn about love? What did you learn about comfort? What did you learn about taking care of yourself? All these questions. Addiction is often tied to early ways that we learn to cope in life, right? And I think one of the primary roles of parents is to help their children understand, articulate, and express the negative emotions in their life, or any emotions, okay? This is my family. This is a couple of years ago. So that's my youngest son on the left. His name's Emerson. And he was diagnosed on the autistic spectrum disorder with autism when he was 3. He is 8 now. And any of you know autism, he's fairly mild, but one of the big things is his emotional regulation, like no emotional regulation, right? He goes from 0 to 100, okay? He doesn't know anything in between. It's like, I'm happy, I'm gonna punch your face, okay? That's kind of how he rolls, okay? And so for him, this was a huge thing of teaching him, what are you feeling? Like, why are you sad? Are you mad? Because it's either just, I'm happy or I want to punch you, right? It's like, okay, there's got to be a bit more emotion, like range of emotions, hopefully. And so we had this tool called, here's a picture. So this was when he got mad because his brother wouldn't help him choose the right character in Mario Kart. and he smashed the TV with the remote. Okay, so that's 0 to 100. Okay, this is an example of how he was. We didn't want our TV smashed anymore, so like, how can we help this child regulate his emotions? So this was something that a psychologist helped us to look at and work with him. And so it's basically, what zone are you in? Four zones of regulation. A lot of schools actually do this now. What zone are you in? Are you in the blue zone? Are you in the green zone? Are you in the yellow zone? Are you in the red zone? And just, you know, kind of giving faces that look like it. It's not great on the screen, but some words, right? Like, and so when Emerson would be going through stuff, we're like, are you in the yellow zone? Like, whoa, you're in the red zone right now. You're in the red zone. You know, we just, and use this to kind of help him to understand what he's feeling, right? Teaching him to slow down. What are you feeling? Can you deal with that? This is about 2 months ago. Emerson and Everett got into this big fight. Emerson ran upstairs and he just threw himself in his bed. And then my wife kind of looks at me. She's, you know, she's like, this is your turn, right? One of those looks. I'm like, okay, I go up. I'm like, Emerson, what's wrong? And he's just lying down in his bed, doesn't even move. I'm like, Emerson, something happened with Everett? I'm like, something probably happened, right? Doesn't even move. I'm like, okay, I'll come back in like 2 minutes when you're ready to talk, right? Go downstairs. Come back up in 2 minutes. Oh, he's sitting in his bed. Emerson, so what happened? Doesn't even look at me, doesn't acknowledge me. I'm like, all right, well, looks like you're calming down, which is good. This is one of your tools, right? Okay, I'm going to come back in like a couple of minutes and maybe we're ready to talk about it, okay? So I leave, come back again. He's reading a book. I said, Emerson, you ready to talk about it? Nope. I'm like, okay, well, you know what? We're going to have to talk about it. So I'm going to come back in 5 minutes and we'll come talk about it. Leave. Come back, I'm like, Emerson, he's like, I'm good, Dad, I'm ready to go play. And then he tries to like leave. I'm like, oh, stop. And I said, hold on here. Okay, so what happened? He's like, well, Everett did this, and then this happened, and then I punched him, and then I was so mad. And then it's like, okay, like, then it was starting to come out. I was like, okay, well, now you need to go and talk with Everett, tell him how you felt, what happened, and how it made you feel, like all this kind of stuff, right? And that was my better moment. You know, I don't do this all the time. I'm just really painting you the best picture of my parenting ability. But this was the process I had to go walk with him through to understand his emotions, his inner world, and to express it in a healthy way. How many of you had parents that did that for you? A safe place to talk about your emotions, to name them, to deal with it in a healthy way, healthy ways of expressing it, that negative emotions were okay, that somebody was going to be there to help you with it. How many of us had that growing up, right? Many of us never had any of that kind of ability. So what do we do with our triggers? Do we actually deal with it? What do we do with our real needs? We don't deal with it. Nobody's ever helped us to articulate our emotions. We just run headlong into our addictions. We just run headlong into explosive anger. We just run headlong into saying nasty things, right? Slow down. What are our triggers? It's really important to become aware of our triggers. It's like the check engine light in our car, right? When we begin to experience temptation under triggers, it's like your car saying, slow down and you gotta pop open your hood. Something's happening, right? You're really struggling with temptation, slow down. It's like that check engine light. How many of you, I hate it when that light goes off. Like, oh man, like, I'll go over a bump and hope it goes away, or I'll turn off my car, turn it on, hope it goes away. Like, I just don't want to deal with it, right? And I think that's kind of the way it is in our life, our emotional lives. Like, I just don't want to deal with it. I'm tired. I don't want to talk about how I hurt my wife again and how I'm, you know, all this kind of stuff. I don't want to do that. And yet, our triggers are saying, check what's happening, right? It's like the psalmist that says, my soul, why are you downcast within me? It's like saying, soul, okay, something's happening. Like, reflect. Why are you downcast? What is happening, right? Are you aware of your triggers? Are you willing to sit down and say, okay, I'm realizing I'm struggling. What's happening? Why am I struggling with this? What's happened throughout my day, right? This is hugely important to deal with your triggers. Because what happens when we don't deal with our triggers is this. We will experience certain triggers and we're like, oh, that's fine. Like, so for example, I will wake up in the morning and I'll see dishes were kind of left out. Oh, that's kind of annoying. Like, oh man, somebody's supposed to wash their dishes. That's just a little trigger, not a big deal. Then I leave for work and I realize, oh, I didn't bring my lunch. I'm gonna have to buy some food again and my wife's gonna criticize me for, you know, not for spending money on food, right? That's another trigger, right? And then I get to work, and the first email is just this long rant by somebody. I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't want to deal with these people again. I have another trigger, right? Then I go home, and I want to relax, but then there's stuff to do. And my wife said, I thought you were cooking dinner. I'm like, what are you talking about? It wasn't my turn. Then we throw in pizza, and then everyone's just kind of upset. You know, another trigger, right? And then I get trigger, and most of it's like, not that big of a deal. Like, I think I'm doing okay. It's kind of like getting one of these punch cards, right, at McDonald's, right? It's like, oh, I'm doing fine. Then when you get to number 7, it's like, I'm not doing fine. I want to cash in, right? And we're like, I want to feel better, right? I want something to make me feel better. I don't care what it is anymore, right? I'm so irritated. I'm feeling an angst, right? This is worth nothing when you only have 1 or 2 or 3, but when you have 7, it's like, I want to cash this in, please. I'd like something nice, right? It's kind of what happens when we don't deal with our triggers, right? We're annoyed, we're irritated. Something isn't going our way, but we actually don't know how to deal with it. We're not dealing with it. And then it just feels like, well, acting out's the only thing that's going to make me feel good. So triggers are important. What are they? Recognizing it, acknowledging it, dealing with it. And the last thing I want to say is breaking out of your cycle. The fact is, at any one of these stages, you can break out of it. Okay, you can do something else. Right? When you recognize you're in it, oh, I'm triggered. Instead of just going down the path of preoccupation, how can I engage my mind in a different way? Instead of going down the path of ritualization, what else can I kind of do? Instead of going down this path, how do I meet my real needs, maybe? How do I acknowledge what I'm actually feeling, right? And so there's ways we actually need to learn to break out of our cycle. That can look like a lot of things, calling out to God, maybe. Like, man, I need to just spend time, like, talking to God and expressing this. Maybe it's accountability. Maybe this is where good accountability happens. It's actually talking to people in the midst of your struggle. Most people do accountability as, who do I talk to when I screw up? Really effective accountability is, who do I talk to, you know, during when I struggle, right? Like, hey, I'm struggling with this. I saw this picture. It's stuck in my mind. I'm really frustrated with my wife. You know, sorry that I bring up my wife all the time, but, you know, it's a big trigger. You know, it's, you have a lot of back and forth. You know, but who do you, like, break out and actually talk to somebody? This is huge. Develop new habits, right? What are some new habits and new coping mechanisms I need to develop? I want to show this video, if it's ready. It's a great little video that just kind of talks about the importance of developing new patterns in our life to cope. Okay, here we go. Great. Perfect.
Our brains are full of neural maps. Every time we learn something, we create a new neural map in our brain. So for example, you might have a neural map about cooking a meal. You may have a neural map that is around learning French or maybe learning to drive. And in fact, the more you practice that skill, the deeper that map becomes, the stronger it becomes in our brain, to the point where you don't even have to think about it very much anymore. So initially, when you started learning to drive the car, you had to think very consciously about where the gear stick was and where the accelerator and the brake was. But over time, as that neural map in your brain becomes stronger and stronger, those actions and behaviours just become automatic. Now, unfortunately, that also happens with addiction. Sex addiction rewires the brain. It creates a new neural map. And one of the key things that helps us remember those maps is a chemical called dopamine. Dopamine is a chemical that is the common denominator in all addiction. It's a chemical that reminds us of the things that are most pleasurable in our lives. So something that triggers dopamine is something that is going to strengthen your neural map. So thinking of perhaps the map of England as a metaphor, imagine Brighton represents your addiction. Brighton represents your acting out behaviour. As someone who's been to Brighton, I know that it's a lovely place. It's very exciting. It's full of lots of different things to do. Somewhere you can lose yourself. Perhaps that's also true of your addiction. London represents everyday life. So you live in London, it's where your everyday life happens. But when you want a dopamine high, you go to Brighton. Now, if you go to Brighton on a regular basis in your addiction, if your acting out has become a regular thing that you do, then that neural pathway in your brain is going to get stronger and stronger and stronger. The more often you drive down that neural pathway, the stronger it will become, the more automatic it will become, like when you learn to drive a car. So that neural pathway in your brain, that road from London to Brighton, becomes a motorway. It becomes the M23, a fast, easy route to access dopamine. Recovery from addiction means not going to Brighton. And it means not thinking about Brighton either, because we know that when you fantasize, you actually trigger the dopamine pathway in the same way. You need never to go to Brighton again, so that motorway can begin to get potholed and grow over. It will become weaker and weaker. But instead, you need to develop new roads, new ways of accessing dopamine. So let's think of some other coastal towns. Perhaps Portsmouth is going to represent another way you can access dopamine. That might be going out with friends. Maybe Littlehampton is playing golf. Maybe Eastbourne is taking up a new musical instrument. Maybe spending more time with family and friends, with loved ones, is Bournemouth. Initially, when you start trying to access those neural pathways, they're going to be little B roads, and you might find yourself having to go to Bournemouth via Leeds. It may take a long time to get to that point of dopamine. And I'm sorry to say, but it's not going to be quite like Brighton. But if you're tempted to go back to Brighton again, you are just going to strengthen that neural pathway. What you have to do is keep going to Bournemouth, keep going to Portsmouth, keep accessing those other types of dopamine so that those roads can become stronger and stronger and stronger.
So recovery from pornography addiction is difficult, absolutely, but not impossible for sure. There are pathways to actually understand the addiction, make sense of it, actually begin to talk about it with people and begin to kind of walk out of it. I used to pray when I was young, God, take this away, and God never answered that prayer. And in many ways, I'm actually thankful that he did. Because it was actually through the process of having to understand myself, of understanding my heart, of understanding my desires, of understanding my past and who I am, that it's actually brought about so much healing to kind of who I am. I've had to understand my emotions. I've had to grieve my past. I've had to actually learn how to receive real comfort from people, real intimacy from people. And it's really been the path towards my own maturity as a person and as a Christian has been through this path of unpacking pornography addiction. And so it's not this treacherous and just, you know, worst thing in the world. We need to do more than just manage the sin in our life. But I think there's really opportunities for great transformation with pornography addiction. So let me close with that. We have been talking for a long time, so I will stand up and I'll say a quick prayer and we'll have a break. Lord, these are heavy topics that we're looking at today and ones that we painfully know affect many of us. And so even with what was said, Lord, would you help to just one or two things land for us? Lord, what are the things that you're asking us to just reflect on more, journal more about? Maybe is there a conversation we need to have out of this with a friend, with an accountability partner, with our spouse? God, would you provide us safe places where we can walk this path of recovery? Friends, accountability guides, mentors to walk with us. We just acknowledge again, we lay our hearts open before you. You know all things, so we don't need to pretend to hide things from you. God, we ask for your ongoing redemption in our life, your ongoing work of transformation. For we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Whew, okay, we will take another 10-minute break, and then we are going to look at understanding Christianity and homosexuality.